Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
In this episode of Path to Zero, we're joined by an expert who focuses on data to help us understand the rapidly changing energy industry. Jeff Krimmel is an energy strategist, consultant, and founder of Foundations of Energy, a learning and development resource on Substack for professionals across the energy sector. Jeff has a PhD in mechanical engineering from Caltech and a background spanning oil field services, refining, and industrial strategy. His writing breaks down everything from oil and gas to renewables and electrification. Jeff, it is great to have you here on Path to Zero. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
We're going to cover a lot of ground today. I can see that. But let's go right to the beginning, kind of, I think, where you come to us, and that is as a data person. And you're using data to really analyze and then to perhaps explain really complex energy markets. So help share an example maybe where this data analytics have led to a significant insight, please.
Yes. I worked recently with a client that works for a large oilfield equipment supplier. And this supplier was going through a capital allocation exercise where they were trying to put a plan together to understand what the returns on this capital investment would look like over a five-year horizon. And in order to do that, they needed some view of how rig counts and oil prices will evolve over the next 5 years. Acknowledging that's a really tough forecast to build, and there's a lot of uncertainty embedded in it. But when you're making these kinds of capital allocation decisions that have multi-year return horizons, you can't not have a view of how the future would evolve. So I used a bunch of data sets to understand better oil supply, oil demand, rig counts, prices, the financial performance of oil and gas producers, and wrapped those all up into a model that stepped out sort of year by year from now out to 2030 to better understand what rig counts, oil production levels, oil prices would look like that far in the future. Not only was it just a lot of fun to put together the machinery that would accomplish something like that, the insights that you build around how you expect oil and gas markets specifically to evolve, but really any commodity market, when you start to make assumptions about how these markets behave, and then you codify these assumptions and you actually build an apparatus that can model the functioning of these markets and then evolve that behavior over time, you really start to tease out and test what do I know about these markets and how should they perform? And when you look at a forecast being built over time, I was able to collaborate with the client and really sort of pressure test, you know, is this model giving us what we'd expect? Would we expect oil and gas markets to evolve this way, knowing what we've known about them historically, what we're seeing out of them today? So it's a good example of how I use a lot of data sets that tell us about the current and the recent past, and in some cases, the more distant past, and use those to help inform what view we should have of the future and test it in a way where we can use it to really drive forward these capital allocation decisions.
Interesting. You know, speaking of markets, and I take it you're really well-versed in oil prices, not gas prices, to a degree that probably you have some views on electricity prices, right?
That's right.
Yeah. It's been amazing to me just in the last month with all the turmoil that was developing between really around Iran and what their 3 or so million barrels a day means to the U.S. But looking at stability of natural gas prices. Natural gas prices fell in that period of all that uncertainty in the known forecast for crazy hot weather and relatively short supply relative to at least a 5 or 10 year study. Yet nat gas prices fall, I guess from my numbers, almost 55 cents. Crazy.
It's wild. It's, you know, some of the stuff is—it's tough to understand and build a coherent explanation around, you know, every move, every pricing move, day to day, week to week, that sort of thing. So some of it is, you know, it can, you can get to the vagaries of, you know, who's hedging what, and, you know, what sort of futures positioning are folks building up or rolling off of, and that can explain some of those movements. But I think that you are right that there is sort of an interesting undercurrent here where there's a lot of expectation of growing demand for natural gas in the near term, intermediate term, and in many cases for the long term. And we're seeing a lot of capital discipline across the U.S. E&P sector. So there's not, you know, a strong belief that we're going to see a huge new wave of supply roll into the market. And yet, like you said, natural gas prices are relatively muted compared to what they would have been. And I think it speaks to a little bit around there is some concern about what happens with global GDP growth as we go through the back half of this year and into 2026. I think also on the gas demand side of the story, more folks are grappling with what sort of supply chain constraints exist toward getting new gas turbines in place where you can, you know, meaningfully generate a lot more electricity using gas going forward than we do today. And knowing some of those constraints exist, that might weigh against some of the demand expectations that we would have for gas.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, while I would love to parse that, let me kind of ask you a broader question, take you back up for a moment, then maybe we'll get back in the weeds. But as you look at the trends in the energy sector today, which trends do you find most compelling? And then really maybe what is your advice to businesses about how they adapt to these changes?
The biggest trend that I pay attention to, because there's a lot of knock-on effects downstream in industry around it, is the capital discipline that we're seeing across the E&P sector. So for oil and gas producers, the hurdle rate required for them to invest back into their own production base, that hurdle rate is growing over time because shareholders have been very clear that if there's any sort of risk of middling returns, we would rather see that capital, that cash returned back to us in the form of dividends or share repurchases. Mm-hmm. And so that has a lot of downstream effects because, like I was just saying about the natural gas production, we're not expecting a wave of huge wave of new natural gas production, given how conservatively E&Ps are deploying capital back into their businesses. So that has a lot of downstream effects because it gets into, okay, how much gas are we going to have available to meet demands around LNG or to meet, you know, future power demands there? You know, then you get to just a broader power space in general, that if you know that oil and gas were constrained on the investment side of that, in part because we have a supply surplus there, you get to some interesting consequences around, you know, how aggressively do we invest in these alternative energy sources to try to supplement what oil and gas may or may not be available for us in the future? So the capital discipline around E&Ps is a big one. And also just because geographically where I'm located, paying a lot of attention to what's happening toward, you know, with the IRA subsidies and the incentives to build out solar and wind and storage facilities, knowing many of those incentives are getting walked back. You know, to what extent does that put a dent into the solar deployments that we would have expected otherwise? And if those are pulled back a little bit, where does other generation technology ramp up in order to step in, knowing that energy demands, you know, power demands specifically, are only going to grow over time? So those are the two trends that I pay the most attention to.
Do you tend to believe the hype about growth in the electric grid based on data center demand? Or do you think maybe that I struggle sometimes to understand the high end of those estimates? I mean, we're talking about an electric grid that maybe didn't grow for 10 or 12 years. Now it's been growing 2 or 3%, but some people talk about a double between now and 2040.
Right. My view there is weaker than the consensus. And I've written about that a handful of times. I think that, you know, that it's well known, right, that in a lot of the power queues across the U.S. that there are projects being double, triple, you know, quadruples submitted to try to find landing spots for some of these projects. So some of this expected capacity add is inflated. And I also just think, so like you, I wrote a LinkedIn post a little while back, a data-driven post showing, yes, you know, electricity supply demand sort of flatlined in the U.S. over a 15, 20-year period. But even when you start talking about the electricity demand growth, the power demand growth that we'd expect from data centers, it really gets us back to the kind of rates of growth we were seeing, you know, right before the turn of the 21st century. So it's the kinds of rates of growth that the U.S. has seen before, has responded to before. And so this idea that we should, you know, have some sort of cataclysmic you know, response to meet all this, and it's completely unlike anything we've ever seen or done before, I don't buy as much into that hysteria.
I know you are an expert about energy companies, both kind of looking at their financial performance, thinking about their future. But as you look at that, you're sitting in Houston today, but how are energy companies performing? And I guess now a little bit more certainty after one big, beautiful bill. It's kind of worked its way through, although some of the details are yet to be forthcoming. And maybe even more importantly, how do you see the renewables portion of those energy companies? How do you see that playing out over the next 5 or 10 years?
So specifically on the renewable side, you know, clearly there's going to be some sort of headwind facing that sector now relative to what had happened before the passage of this most recent bill. But, you know, in general, the way that I do energy analysis, and this might not be a perfect heuristic for me to use, but it's served me well enough that I do rely on it quite a bit, is, you know, in whatever way the pendulum swings and you start to see a strong emotional reaction, I try hard to take the other side of that change. So, you know, a lot of renewable advocates these days are, again, it's a cataclysm, the sky's falling sort of deal. And I definitely don't believe that. When you study, and I have, say, the financial performance of investor-owned utilities in the U.S., and you see these investor-owned utilities have deployed renewables and other low-carbon sources at different rates, but NextEra is one of the most visible of this cohort. You still see quite a bit of financial strength and resilience here, and you see that growing over time. And in part, that's because the costs of many of these renewable systems are going down. And so when you find the right sites on which to deploy these low carbon systems and take advantage of the natural resource that exists, much like you have to do with oil and gas, much like historically had been done with coal, you will find very attractive locations that make an enormous amount of financial sense. So I don't see the passage of this most recent bill and think this low carbon growth trajectory that we're on is going to look night and day different than it did before. We will see some headwinds on the margins. There would be some projects that would have been marginally attractive before that are now marginally unattractive as a result of this bill. So you won't see those projects go forth. But I think the project of continuing to explore and build out and deploy and experiment with an increasing low carbon energy apparatus, that project will continue to exist with a fair bit of capital deployed behind it, regardless of the details of the bill that was just passed.
You know, two assessments I've had. One, green hydrogen, not gray hydrogen, or maybe even some of the other shades around gray, but green hydrogen certainly probably is going to be scaled back as we think about North America. I mean, I'm still not sure what to think about the European views, but clearly, and the other one that looks to me to probably be a little bit in doubt is what I'd call grid scale solar wind, right? And certainly those three energies probably will take a little bit of a dip in contributions to the grid, wouldn't you think?
Certainly on the green hydrogen side, I've studied that a bit, less so than others, but I have studied a bit, and green hydrogen just has an enormous cost challenge everywhere, right? So to the extent that, there are, governments around the world that are comfortable knowing that you're going to be at an economic loss pursuing that, then fine. But the road to economic viability for green hydrogen seems really long and winding, and it's not a place that I would bet we'll see much development there. On the grid scale solar and wind side, I think that is more of an issue. If you find the right sites for those facilities and you take advantage of the most potent, most abundant areas of natural resource, technologies can absolutely contribute. But, given the passage of the bill and walk back of some of the subsidies around that, absolutely, there would be solar and wind plants that in the past would have been built that now no longer will be built, because without those early runs of subsidies, you just can't get the math to pencil.
Yeah. So first off, I want to talk about your writings. I read you on Substack some, but you also have a wonderful newsletter, right? Foundations of Energy. Are those the two places generally people could follow your writings? Is that where you'd recommend?
Yes, there's those two places. And then on LinkedIn proper is where I share a lot of research. So the way that my workflows tend to go is I'll write some quick hit research pieces and post those on LinkedIn nearly every day of the week, certainly multiple times a week. And then I have a free weekly newsletter that I call the Business of Energy. And that one, I have links to everything that I've shared on LinkedIn with some summaries. I have a podcast, so there's a link to my podcast. I have the Substack newsletter, there's links to that. So the free weekly newsletter called The Business of Energy is sort of a one-stop shop that has everything that I do. And then there's the Substack newsletter that's called Foundations of Energy. And the Substack newsletter is where I take an energy topic of importance of the day, you know, something typically that shareholders, management teams, politicians are thinking about trying to navigate through. And I will explore those energy topics from first principles. I wanted Foundations of Energy to be a case where, smart, curious people that are building their careers in energy, but, don't have fluency across all domains of energy, want to learn about and ultimately possibly be a part of the conversations around energy that are happening in a lot of places. And so it's a place where I can introduce vocabulary, I can introduce new concepts, I can draw analogies from one sector of energy to another. And what I say there is I'm trying to help us all better understand what today's energy systems look like and how these energy systems are evolving over time, and specifically trying to help aspiring and existing energy professionals build up their strategy and finance acumen. That's the mission at Foundations of Energy.
Yeah, I highly recommend the listeners that are enjoying listening to you today find some of those sources to follow you, because it's interesting. When I read you, a lot of times you're really talking about primary energy. It's a term I don't hear a lot of people use. What is primary energy, and why is it so important for you to discuss?
Primary energy is the foundational source of the energy that human beings then harvest in some ways. And typically that harvesting involves a transformation. So the classic case, given our energy use patterns today, is in oil and gas. There's energy embedded in the chemical bonds of these subsurface hydrocarbons. And so we go produce these hydrocarbons. And then we transform that energy that exists in the chemical bonds, the hydrocarbons, into useful forms of energy that we deploy in all kinds of ways. The other examples of primary energy would be the sunlight that hits the earth, the wind that's blowing across the earth, the energy that's embedded in the atoms of radioactive materials. All of these are primary forms of energy, almost none of which humans can use directly as is. And so when you think about it from, when you sort of trace it back from primary energy to getting to the energy that human beings use to flourish the way we flourish today, if you understand that reasonably well, you basically understand the whole energy industry of the world. And you can understand why these energy systems have evolved the way they have, why they're connected the way they are, why you would expect them to change, and what areas of innovation are being targeted. Because it really is as simple as we're just trying to transform all this energy that either exists under the surface of the earth, or is landing on the earth from the sun, or is blowing across the surface of the earth. All we're trying to do is find those energy sources and transform them into energy that we can use.
It's time for our break. We'll be back for our conversation with Jeff Krimmel right after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. Let's continue our exciting conversation with energy strategist Jeff Krimmel. So you're thinking about advising multinational companies. Do you struggle with kind of where we are? I'll even say North America versus, I used to say Europe. Now I have to say Western Europe, Eastern Europe, or Asia. Or is it fairly clear to you how to provide energy around the world in a way that is affordable and, for lack of a better word, clean enough?
Right. There is a lot of variability in how you could provide energy around the world. And like you said, and I think there's a lot embedded in how you close that sort of being clean enough, right? We know that there's challenges around the affordability of energy, the availability of energy, and then you have the environmental sustainability piece. And all three of those matter an enormous deal. And every area of the world grapples with those three factors in different ways. And they have leaned into and away from different elements at different times, depending on how economies are performing, based on just general public sentiment, based on any near-term environmental challenges that have existed. Those will steer, how different governments will respond to different energy sources, how these multinational companies that you're talking about are responding to them. So it's definitely not a one-size-fit-all. Like, hey, look, we're trying to decarbonize the world's energy systems, so let's just lean thoroughly into decarbonization. Every fork in the road, let's just take the path toward lower carbon intensity. No, that's definitely not the right way to go about it. There are real returns considerations. There's access considerations. And it varies by different parts of the world. And also, when you're talking about primary energy, that's what I mentioned earlier when we were talking about solar and wind, there are areas where the solar irradiance is incredibly strong. And you can get a very nice return off of solar investments in those areas. There's other parts of the world where that solar irradiance is relatively weak. And almost no matter what you would do, you're not going to be able to harvest solar energy in a super attractive way that will allow you to meet energy needs at scale. The same is true for wind. We see the same things, of course, for oil and gas. They exist where they exist. They don't where they don't. And so we have real variability in the sources of energy. No matter what their carbon intensity, this variability exists everywhere. And then you have different political appetite, different public appetite for pursuing different technologies. So no, it's a long-winded way for me to say there's a lot of nuance and variability as you go around the world to how we're going to meet these energy needs. And so you do have to sort of zoom in and really explore with some nuance what the right answers look like in different places.
For me, I certainly believe that energy creates economies that then flourish with manufacturing and GDPs. Do you see where we are today? Do you see a change in manufacturing powers around the globe? Or do you think we'll kind of stay relatively where we've been for the last 20, 30, 50 years?
I see a fair bit of change in manufacturing patterns. And it's exactly the reason that you said it really is affordable access to an abundance of energy. If you can drive that, that is one key component. It's not the only key component, but it is one key component to having a robust manufacturing footprint. And there's lots of stories, when you go back and read through the history of U.S. unconventionals and specifically shale gas, there's a reason that so much industrial activity was unlocked along the Gulf Coast in the U.S. circa 2010 to today. And it's because you have so much natural gas that's so inexpensive that here in the U.S., along the Gulf Coast specifically, we can have an enormous industrial footprint there that affords a great deal of security and a great deal of economic activity. And so as energy patterns change, where different places lean into different technologies that allow them cheap energy abundance, that could drive manufacturing activities, I think you'll see those manufacturing centers emerge. That combined with, I think, just around the world, particularly at this moment in time, there's greater appreciation around the security concerns that you have if you've offshored the entirety of your manufacturing needs. Right. You are now beholden to a supply chain that you have, in some cases, very little control of. In other cases, they're actively hostile toward you, right? So I think a lot of countries are thinking through how do you redomicile or at least friendshore some of this manufacturing activity in a way to promote national security that kind of thinking didn't exist in the same way 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I do completely agree. In one of your writings, you really talk about the oil and gas industry is at the mid-century mark. And I kind of think of that as maybe we're in the seventh inning of a nine-inning baseball game. You also talk a lot about never before seen structural constraints you see for this industry. Talk about all of that for a moment.
I have given a handful of talks recently about capital discipline in the oil and gas sector and what it is, what it means, and what impact it has on the future. And I start those talks by having a view of oil and gas out to 2050, oil and gas demand specifically. And I made sure to pull the two most bullish forecasts that I could find for oil demand out to 2050. The most bullish one comes from OPEC, so we can start there. In OPEC's most recent view out to 2050, they showed oil demand growing at a 0.6% compound annual growth rate between now and 2050. And when you look back since the turn of the century, and you can go back, you know, back to the mid-1980s, oil demand globally has grown at about a 1.2% compound annual growth rate. So OPEC sees oil demand growth halving from now to 2050 compared to what it's been historically. My argument is, if you take any sector of the global economy and you cut its long-term growth rate in half, you're going to see some real structural changes in that sector. And that's very much what we're seeing right now with oil and gas. So you don't have to buy into some of the forecasts that are showing oil demand rolling over, you know, by the early 2030s or 2040 and dropping, you know, aggressively as you get to 2050. OPEC shows a continued growth out to 2050, but the growth moderates so much. And even in their cases, most of the growth is front loaded. When you get to 2035, 2040, the growth rates really start to come down. So what that means is that's a big part of the reason that oil and gas companies and these management teams are being so disciplined in how they deploy capital. Is they want to make sure that they have a long, sustainable runway in front of them of assets that they can produce that aren't going to get stranded over time. So that they need to be low-cost producers, knowing that these commodity markets have always been volatile and will very likely become even more volatile as we go forward in time. And you know, they need to be able to promise shareholders the idea that we can return cash over a long period of time, and we can meet the world's energy needs. And as these demand growth rates come down, we are best positioned to meet the needs that the world will have at that point in time. So it's just a different calculus than when oil demand was just growing super aggressively, where you could just make sure it nominally scales with GDP growth, and you know, the world found a way to absorb the barrels that were being thrown at it. That whole calculus just becomes a little bit more precarious as we get toward 2050.
How does an energy company make an investment that's going to span two or three decades in light of all of the worldwide uncertainty and in light of a lot of technology innovations? I mean, I'm fascinated. I think I tracked my fourth contract over the weekend to buy power from fusion. And I'd like to have the under on that bet, as we're really not in the spot. But how does an energy company make multi-decade investments in a world that seems to be changing almost by the quarter?
The simplest answer there is competitiveness, cost competitiveness. It's always mattered to energy companies. Oil and gas companies have learned this a long time ago, and they're very well practiced in it. Not all of them are able to achieve, you know, the same degree of competitiveness, of course, but they all know the importance of being the low cost provider of each incremental barrel of oil or incremental unit of natural gas. But when you extrapolate across the energy sector more broadly, like you say, when there's this much uncertainty and we don't know exactly which technologies will mature at which rates and how widely they'll be deployed over what period of time, it's incredibly important for whatever you know, energy source you provide as an energy company to make sure you are profoundly competitive in deploying that resource. And so it's a matter of making sure that you have the right in-house expertise, that you have the right balance sheet, your cost of capital, you can make it as low as possible, that you're able to target these frontier resources, pursue this innovation in a way that as the market continues to evolve and mature, and as demands grow, you're at the front of that. You're not going to get left behind and be disrupted on a timescale that you don't control. And so all of those things, right, are easy to say, and they've been taught in MBA courses for a long time. What my argument is not that any of those ideas in a vacuum are necessarily novel, but I think management teams are seeing firsthand today that the urgency and the stakes around each of those elements are only growing. And this is becoming an increasingly multidimensional challenge where you have to balance being cost competitive. So I can't just race out and acquire every interesting asset and bring on every you know, smart person and deploy endlessly, you know, capital endlessly into all sorts of potential innovation channels. Like, I have to be targeted about how I'm going to invest for this future disruption. But at the same time, I do need to be invested to allow me to take advantage of this disruption, but be conservative enough that my cost base today is manageable. I'm protecting my balance sheet, driving down my cost of capital. So all these things were known, but I think it's just the flywheel spinning even faster. The degrees of freedom are going up, the degree of difficulty is going up, and management teams are really feeling that today.
Yeah, great response. Last question for you. I love talking to people who study the data. You wrote about how the electric grid has really relied on waves of different generations. You call out coal and nuclear 70s and 80s, kind of then we moved into nat gas as we entered the 21st century, largely driven by the shale plays. Then you talked about a solar and storage boom, but I might think that was a fairly brief boom compared to these other periods. Walk us through, as you were writing that story, maybe the major insights, and then maybe talk about even how the power grid is changing.
The major insights that I gained doing that study was just the U.S. power grid has seen waves of new additions over time, right? It's not been a steady build out of all technologies in parallel. As new technologies come online and become cost competitive and sort of prove that they can contribute in a meaningful way, the grid, the U.S. has leaned hard into adding those resources to the grid. So in the 1970s and 1980s, you see this big wave of both coal plants and of nuclear plants being built. And it's a really aggressive deployment through those two decades. And then you see that sort of wane. And as you get into the late 1990s, there's this huge spike in natural gas deployments. That's when the combined cycle facilities really proved out and became known. And so you see this most aggressive, and it's kind of interesting of any one detail that I looked at. The natural gas buildouts in 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, that time frame, are remarkable. They put to shame all the waves that we've seen before then and since then, even the solar and storage boom that we're seeing today. It is really tough to appreciate just how aggressively we built out natural gas power generation at the turn of the 21st century. So you see that huge build out. Then you see a sort of a small mini wave of wind get built out and deployed pretty aggressively from, say, 2005 to 2015-ish. And now we're seeing this wave of solar and storage boom. And so this is how power capacity has been added over time on the grid, is that as these two new technologies mature and develop and we start deploying them more widely, we start to see them emerge on the grid. And almost all of them have a geographical concentration to it. So it's not like different regions of the U.S., their power grids look exactly the same. So there is a cyclical wave-like element to the power grid. It is a living, breathing. It's what you said. One of the first words you said when we started our conversation was the energy transformation. It is a constantly transforming tool at our disposal. And when you go back to that data, you realize just how dynamic the power grid itself is.
And everybody, I love that everybody loves a shiny new bullet, the shiny new object to place all their hope on. And we've been there for a while with solar and wind. I think we were there for a while with hydrogen. Kind of, if I were to guess now, I would say the shiny new object is nuclear, but hard to imagine that nuclear, whether it's large scale or small modular, that it would be there for us for 15 years, right? You see that differently?
I do not see it differently.
It's just what it takes.
That's the huge challenge with nuclear, right? And it's there's so much promise around it. The technology is incredibly attractive. The amount of capital being thrown at it, the amount of brains of intellectual capital being thrown at it, it's incredibly impressive. And there's just really not a path that I see to advanced nuclear contributing to meeting our energy needs within the next certainly 10-ish years. And then you get to the natural gas turbine supply constraints, where even the GE Vernovas of the world are saying no, we're not aggressively building out our capacity. We want to make sure that we meet what's already in our backlog, right, and then see how durable this emerging demand for natural gas really is.
And they too have shareholders and financial constraints, just like your oil and gas clients.
Exactly right. And a lot of them are well versed in the oil and gas space. And so they know this wave like structure that exists. And if you get out over your skis, you can be left with a lot of capital on hand that's not earning an attractive return. And so they want to be conservative and make sure they're responding the right way. And so it gets to be pretty interesting of what's going to come online at enough scale in the next 5, 7, 10 years to really allow us to meet the power demands that we know are going to be there. That's a pretty interesting question to ponder and reflect on.
But the answer to me is fairly obvious. We might work our geothermal solutions best we can. Solar and wind, now that we know kind of what the definition of unconstructed date means, we'll see some solar and wind, mainly onshore wind, will kind of finish be built out. But it's back to where you're saying about that natural gas in the 2000s. Subject to supply constraints around equipment, it's probably going to be natural gas that fulfills a lot of that gap again for the next 5 to 10 years.
That's right. A lot of that
thinking domestically. I always have to remember natural gas isn't such, you know, a strong contender on a worldwide basis.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it has it definitely has its own regional flavors. And that's an area I'm paying a lot of attention to in my research now. I'm paying more attention to the industrial equipment manufacturers and really trying to understand, you know, how aggressively are we collectively going to lean into, you know, having this second, really kind of third wave of natural gas. When I wrote that first post showing the waves of additions over time, what was interesting, and frankly for me, just kind of unexpected, is I didn't realize the steam turbine natural gas developments, the deployments that we saw through the 1970s and 80s, I didn't realize how aggressive that was. I still classify the 70s and 80s as largely being a coal and nuclear story, but there was quite a bit of deployment in the way of you know, steam right. turbine natural gas facilities. It was really the combined cycle facilities that unlocked that second wave circa 2000. And it's going to be very interesting to see if and when this third wave materializes, how long it takes to get here, and then how durable it is over time. That's an area that I'm studying right now.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, let's have a little fun. We love to ask our guests that have opinions, and I think you'll fit right in with this, to take a magic wand that I'm going to hand you in just a moment. Use that magic wand one time for one wish in the next year. So lots of ones. One wish, next year. One thing that you think would have the biggest impact on this energy transformation. Jeff, how would you use it?
The one thing I would do, and believe me, I know how absurd this sounds, but I would wave the wand and eliminate any tribalism that's embedded in our energy conversation. That we have a very real you know, energy challenge in front of us, trying to make sure that we continue to meet the world's growing demand for energy. And we do it with the energy being, like you said, clean enough, cheap enough, abundant enough to allow human beings to thrive. And it's a shame that there's enough tribalism embedded. You know, the research that I do is all, I try to make it all data-driven and frankly, kind of agnostic to the energy source in terms of what I'm trying to do is find out which energy sources are going to check these boxes, the affordability, the availability, and the sustainability mm-hmm. boxes in a way that allows it to get deployed at scale around the world. And for, you know, the sort of tribalism, the emotion that exists around a lot of that conversation, if I could strip that out and make it more of a, you know, physics-based, engineering-based, you know, sort of political reality based, like there is a political element to it, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, team red rooting in one direction, team blue rooting in a different direction, and that creating unnecessarily conflict. But it's a super interesting challenge to work through. And it's kind of a shame that you know, it becomes as unnecessarily emotional as it does.
And in your case, tribalism, does it transcend politics and maybe even goes back to individual industries in their own sector? So a bit of tribalism inside the oil industry, a bit of tribalism inside the gas industry. Is it bigger than politics?
It's bigger than politics. Yes. I think it's because, you know, it's understandable why it exists, right? Because energy is so central to all of our lives. And, you know, when people have built whole careers around a single source of energy, they of course become, you know, deeply wedded to that. And they have seen firsthand all the power and the value and the benefit that energy source brings to the world. And so many of these energy sources, all of them have merits and demerits, right? They all have benefits, they all have costs. And so the deployment calculus changes place by place, you know, time by time. And so we need to, you know, again, me sort of in magic wand territory, if I was trying to architect the most effective transformation imaginable, it would be how much, you know, can we put down of the baggage that we're carrying around, you know, why this one energy technology is fantastic or why it's the worst thing that humans have ever pursued, to be able to put that down and really judge kind of case by case how, because we're going to cobble something together it's going to be optimal in a collection in a way that we're not taking any one source and just maximizing it. Like there's going to be a balance to all of this. And that's why I kind of tend to think in that direction with my magic wand.
I can totally get behind that use of the magic wand. That's wonderful. Thank you. All right. A last treat we love to do is recognition of your expertise you share with us. We love to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of the time you spent with us. Is there a place you'd love us to go?
My immediate thought is the Arapaho National Forest in Colorado. My oldest son was born in Denver. We have spent a fair bit of time in Estes Park, Colorado. We probably go up there every 2 or 3 years for a week or so at a time. And we're about to go up later this year. So we're excited about that. So we've spent a lot of time in Rocky Mountain National Park and, you know, just in the kind of wilderness writ large and in Colorado. And so that place is pretty special. I've had a lot of fun up in that area. And so I think that'd be a great place to plant a new tree.
And it's a beautiful spot and one that we would love to find a place to put a tree for you. Thank you very much. Anything else you want to share with our listeners? Something you're working on or exciting insight that you're kind of beginning to hone in on?
Well, the thing that's top of mind to me here being on your podcast, I just launched a podcast of my own that's just a weekly 20-minute discussion of my research. So for folks that are listening to this that maybe you don't scroll LinkedIn, maybe you don't do a ton of newsletter reading, but you like to listen to energy research in audio format, that's something I just launched. I'm 3 episodes in. I'm having a lot of fun doing that. It's a good way for me to go back through the research and to sort of tie a thread through a lot of the different pieces that I'm working on and reflecting on. And I think it's a good way to offer even a little more context and perspective around there's a lot of moving parts in the energy world these days. And spending a little bit of time, digging through that and, again, trying to put those pieces together is really valuable. So if folks are listening to this, if you like the idea of listening to energy research in podcast form, it's called Energy Research Brief. And I'd love folks to check it out and let me know what you think about it.
Energy Research Brief.
That's it.
It's great. Thanks. Yeah, I find our listeners are very interested in going beyond the soundbite. They want to understand some of the science and engineering and the financials. And so that's great. I'm sure they will be tuned into that. So, Jeff Krimmel, thank you so much for being with us on Path to Zero. We look forward to following you on all those channels and listen to your podcast. Thank you.
Well, Tucker, thanks so much for having me. It was an absolute blast, and hopefully we get to do it again sometime.
Thank you. If you like what you heard from Jeff Krimmel and our other guest on Path to Zero, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app or YouTube and post a review. It really helps to expand our audience. Path to Zero interviews are also available on my new Substack newsletter, along with articles and insights on clean energy innovation. You can find me on Substack at pathtozero.substack.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time on Path to Zero.